Okay, it's my privilege to introduce to you the moderator of our next panel, Chuck DeRoss, a partner at Morrison & Foster, known around the country as Mr. FCPA, and has been for quite some time. Anyway, Chuck is a former deputy chief of the Justice Department's fraud section, and in that capacity, he headed up the FCPA unit for a number of years, and if I recall correctly, brought cases in 50 different countries. Is that about right? Or
well, not in those countries, but about those countries.
About those countries, okay. And actually did bring 40 cases during his reign against a number of entities and individuals. And matter of fact, his unit was responsible for the conviction of 24 individuals for FCPA violations. He's going to share his expertise, as he's done before for us. It's really an honor to have him here. And if you'd introduce to your panel, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. Great. Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's always a difficult thing to get people's attention after lunch. So hopefully we've got coffee, some Diet Coke, Coke Zero, Pepsi. I think they're Pepsi products here. Anyway, so good afternoon. I'm going to warn everybody, I actually have a call at 2 o'clock. So I am going to be on time. We're going to be moving this thing along. We're going to get you lots of information and ethics credit in a one-hour period. Ethics. I got an email about ethics. So we're going to talk about ethics. So we have a fantastic panel. I'm going to move quickly. I'm going to have them introduce themselves. No pressure. No pressure. You have to go fast. But we have right next to me is Jason Rose from the SEC. We met each other years ago. I'll have him introduce himself, and then we'll go down the line.
As Chuck said, my name is Jason Rose. I'm in the Fort Worth office of the SEC in the Enforcement Division there. I've been there since 2003. Since 2007, I've been working FCPA cases, and I've been a member of the FCPA unit based in Fort Worth since the unit was founded, I believe, in early 2010.
And an ass kicker. He won't say that. I'm just going to throw that out there. Mr. FCPA, ass kicker. Okay. Kelly Thorman.
I don't have any exciting nicknames, though.
Oh, well, we'll make them up. It's all right.
I'm Kelly Thorman, and I am Associate General Counsel and Director of Compliance for Parker Drilling, a drilling and related services company in Houston. Been there about 3 years, and before that I spent quite a while in D.C. at Norton Rose Fulbright practicing mostly FCPA compliance investigations. And now I do not only FCPA, but also sanctions and a bunch of other stuff.
Excellent. And down at the end is Casey Kaplan. I have him introduce himself.
I'm Casey Kaplan. Chuck and I have known each other for 3 minutes now, so we go way back.
Very close.
Like this. I am Assistant General Counsel for Litigation and Investigations at Nike out in Beaverton, Oregon. Been there 3 years. Before that, I was at the SEC. Fort Worth Regional Office with Jason and a bunch of you other people that are no longer there. And before that, I was at K&L Gates for several years here in Dallas, where probably half of you spent at least some point portion of your career there.
Fantastic. All right, so we have a very exciting panel, eminently qualified panelists, and we are going to cover a couple of different topics, some major developments in, it says international enforcement investigations is really sort of another word for FCPA. So we're going to cover that and then other developments more broadly, cross-border discovery-related issues. We'll touch upon GDPR as part of that. And, of course, ethics. Of course, ethics. And everybody wants to get those credits. So we're going to turn first to Jason, as I think is sort of the standard process here when you have a government representative. I'm going to throw it over to him and ask him if maybe he could first give us maybe some of those statistics that everybody likes to hear about SEC-related enforcement in the FCPA space, so those of you can sort of jot it down, and whether you're going to go talk to clients externally or internally, you can go use those to scare people to do the right thing.
And I'll give the disclaimer I'm sure everybody else has given from the government. These views are my own. No one else's, not the commissioner at staff. Having said that, as Chuck suggested, I'll start off with some statistics. These are from calendar year 2018, so about three-quarters of the way through the year. The SEC has brought 9 corporate FCPA enforcement actions so far. Interestingly, only 3 of those actions was there a parallel DOJ component, which I think is probably low based on history, and maybe Chuck could give his thoughts on that later. But despite the fact there are only nine actions, there's pretty diverse range of misconduct, industries represented, et cetera. So far, aviation, distilled beverages, elevators, financial services, mining, pharma, and real estate have been hit in those nine actions. So not focusing on one particular area, pretty broad-based number of actions this year. And the countries involved similarly have been pretty widespread as well. Azerbaijan, China, Ghana, India, Indonesia, Kazakhstan, Kuwait, Libya, Mauritania, Pakistan, Romania, South Korea, and Thailand. And those are just the named countries. And a lot of those actions, you'll see sometimes they'll, in the orders, refer to just the Middle East region or Asia Pacific region. So in reality, there's even more countries than that impacted just by those nine corporate actions. The SEC has also brought one individual enforcement action to date this year against an individual named Dennis Bond, who's a real estate broker, who attempted to pay a bribe in connection with the sale of a high-rise building in Vietnam. Unfortunately for Mr. Bond, his sidekick co-conspirator stole the money, misrepresented the involvement of the foreign official. Mr. Bond was still convicted criminally and paid an SEC penalty as well. So that's a high-level summary of the FCPA actions brought by the SEC today.
No honor among thieves. I think that's one of the takeaways. No honor among thieves. So one of the questions, Jason, that I know many of my clients are asking and have been asking, and many of the people in the room may be wondering, is what is, if anything, going to be the sort of Trump effect in terms of the administration? I think most people probably read the news that he had some negative things to say about the FCPA back in 2012 when interviewed as just a citizen on CNBC in the wake of some news about Walmart. I'm just curious, from your perspective, speaking on your own individual behalf and not on behalf of the SEC, as we now know, any Trump effect?
I have not seen a Trump effect. I would say, and I think I said the same thing last year, SEC enforcement in the time I've been doing
it. You guys are late. All right. Sorry. Take it personally. It's all right.
Over the last decade when I've been involved in FCPA enforcement, I think the general trend has been more and more enforcement over time, more sophisticated actions, more resources dedicated by both the SEC and DOJ to it, and the new administration, in my opinion, really hasn't changed that trend. We're still enforcing the FCPA as vigorously as we did in the last administration and the one prior to that.
Because there's no DOJ rep, I will play that role for just one moment. So if Dan Kahn or one of those other folks were here, he would probably say there have been six corporate DOJ actions so far this year in 2018, of which there were three that, as Jason was just referring, overlapped with SEC. It's interesting. I will point this out as a trend, which is, frankly, back in the day when I was there, which is now a number of years ago, there were some cases that were SEC standalone cases, but those tended to be more the exception than the rule. The last number of years, there's actually been what I kind of call the great divide, in which there is sort of a specific, and you can see it, sort of determined idea that there are going to be more cases that SEC brings and DOJ won't. I suspect some of the policy reasons for that is that DOJ simply says, look, this doesn't strike us as criminal in nature. There are certain cases that frankly fall within the sort of the mandate or the mission of SEC better. So if you look back, 2016, 56% of the cases brought, corporate cases by SEC, were standalone. In 2017, 58%. And as Jason was just pointing out, so far in 2018, 66%. Are standalone SEC cases. And I would just sort of point out to those out there, because often DOJ, I think, tends to get sort of more coverage in terms of FCPA enforcement. If you're a company, I got to tell you, the one that you really, really, really have to be concerned about is SEC. They bring more cases, and it's the accounting provisions. Everybody always talks about anti-bribery. It's the accounting provisions, dummy. Because they are 100% of the cases last year brought by SEC were included accounting provision charges, and 100% so far this year accounting provision cases, and last year and this year more than half, this is the one you need to listen to, more than half were accounting provision cases only, standalone accounting provisions, not the anti-bribery charges. So if what you're thinking about, what you need to focus on or things to think about going forward is books and records and internal controls. Because you may say you can't prove bribery, but then SEC says, well, maybe we can't, but we can go with this. And from a jurisdictional perspective, there's no wire requirement, and so it's universal. So it has much greater coverage. The one other thing I would point out, and I agree all the same things that Jason said about SEC apply to DOJ, which is no country has a monopoly on corruption. It's everywhere. It's Africa, it's Asia, it's South America, it's Eastern Europe. Every industry can be impacted. So it really is sort of opportunistic in that from that perspective. What I would point out are two things in terms of DOJ, which I think are very interesting and I would sort of keep my eye on going forward, which is there are five trials, scheduled trials in DOJ FCPA cases. Now, Ben's sitting there thinking, like, those guys never try any cases because he used to do the healthcare fraud cases and the financial fraud cases, and all the guys in the fraud section where I was like, those FCPA guys just hang out in conference rooms and cut deals. Well, so at least now we know, there are... Oh, somebody has jokes. Okay, we don't have time. So we're going to keep moving. But so five trials scheduled between that in the next 6 months, and they have, in the PDVSA case, so I know a lot of people here care about energy, 17 individuals have been charged in the last few years related to PDVSA, including 10 government officials in which they were charged for money laundering where the underlying specified unlawful activity was the FCPA. So it's essentially DOJ getting aggressive going after the foreign officials. Not something necessarily SEC is really part of their mandate or they have the tools to do, but certainly something DOJ has been doing. Okay, so that's DOJ in a nutshell. And I will agree, by the way, from what we've seen, both in terms of statements by government officials, DOJ and SEC, the actions that they brought publicly in all these cases, individuals and corporate, you don't see any slowdown, any change. I think it can be a real risk out there. But so that's, we don't see any of that. And in the cases that we have with DOJ and SEC, we've seen no change. There's no Trump effect that I can see. But let me, actually, I was talking just earlier to Kelly about that. And I think one of the dangers about sort of this discussion about the Trump effect from a compliance and in-house sort of investigations perspective is, do people start to say, well, wait a minute, is this a priority anymore? And I mean, can that have an impact internally from a compliance perspective and a focus on compliance?
It certainly does. I mean, these are the questions that you get, right, as in-house counsel for these issues. You have people asking, well, what's going to change now that we have President Trump? And my response, even before being able to see the statistics, is, Jason was Jason before and after the administration changed. He is not going to be less inclined to do his job today than he was 2 years ago. If you had Chuck in his chair at DOJ, he's not going to all of
Cut
a sudden
deals,
decide that he's not going to prosecute. Our government enforcement officials, DOJ and SEC, that's their job. That's what they want to do. That's what they are good at, and that's what they know how to do. And so that's the message that I keep having to relay to our internal folks, that even when the administration changes, that doesn't mean that our focus needs to change. It shouldn't change.
And kind of following on that, as a lot of you in this room probably know, there's only five political appointees at the SEC. There's a chairman and then two commissioners from either party. So the vast majority of the staff stays the same. It's not where DOJ, where there's a turnover and, you're all Republican, all Democrat.
Wow.
As far as the leadership, SEC's bipartisan, so although the chairman might change, you still have the minority party kind of as a check on that. So I think it might moderate some of the changes between administrations a little bit just by the structure of the commission.
Sure. Since Paul Pelletier is not here, I'm going to say this just for his – Paul used to refer to all the politicals that came into the Department of Justice as tourists. And he was like, they're going to be here and then they're going to leave. And I think that's generally sort of the career professional's view of things. So the other
fact is that these cases take years.
Yes.
So it may start in one administration, it's going to end in a different one, or vice versa. And so we can't be looking at who's in office today to determine how to respond and what controls to put into place.
How many years have you been gone, Chuck?
Oh, I've been gone 4.5.
Yeah, and there's still cases we worked on.
Oh, yeah, there are a couple of those still hanging around. We won't talk about some of those. So Casey, I'm curious. I mean, obviously, there's been a lot that's been going on in the past year, both in the U.S. and abroad, in terms of foreign bribery enforcement, corruption, some developments like anything that you've been focused on or thinking about, from your sort of current position in-house, whether that's from an investigations or a compliance perspective.
Yeah, just from the business standpoint, I think it's important from an in-house perspective, different from external, is knowing where your business is growing, knowing what geographies your footprint's getting larger in so that you can adjust, because whether it's our compliance team or our investigations team, you still take a risk-based approach. And so if we've got a growing presence in China and smaller footprint somewhere else, then we're going to be focused on, committing more resources there and understanding the landscape better.
Right. So Kelly, we were talking earlier, actually, and one of the things, the focus, of course, I'm a bit myopic, I guess is probably the best word to describe it, in terms of foreign bribery, but we were talking about there have been a lot of international developments in terms of enforcement beyond the sort of FCPA piece. I'm just wondering maybe to give some people here some of the things that are on your mind or keep you up at night might be helpful.
I think the thing that's been the most challenging in the last few years, especially in the oil and gas industry and financial services industries, is the Russian sanctions. That as these continue to expand and the list gets longer and longer, and there was just an announcement about 2 hours ago that we're trying to understand, that apparently appears to now say that principals and chief executives of sanctioned entities are now sanctioned. We'll figure out what this means and how we're supposed to interpret that and apply it. It's this kind of thing that has been keeping me up at night. The Russian sanctions have originally started applying only to business that was in Russia. Now it applies to any business anywhere with those sanctioned companies if there are certain kinds of projects. So it's not as straightforward as the sanctions that we used to deal with, where it was just don't go to Iran, period. That's much easier, right? These are much more complex, and as you're trying to, especially in the oil and gas industry in the last few years, where there has been just a little bit of an issue with the market in general, you're trying to make sure that you can play in all of the markets where it's allowed, but that means that you've got to spend a lot more time trying to understand what the rules are so that you can play in the field where you're supposed to play, but not cross that line.
Interesting. So I'm curious, Jason, in terms of, everyone always wants to pull out of SEC enforcement actions or DOJ some, words of wisdom, some sort of tea leaves that they're reading. What's the messaging that the government's trying to send from a compliance perspective so that people in the sort of the regulated community sort of understand what the expectations are? Are there, from the past year or so, things that you think, SEC's focused on or more of the same, or what do you think?
I don't know if there's any particular new focus for 2018, but I think you see some of the same types of issues repeated from year to year to year. Third-party intermediaries. Pretty much every case, I think every corporate enforcement action but one, had some form of a third-party intermediary involved in the bribe scheme. So due diligence associated with those individuals, hugely important. And they pop up in all different contexts, too. For instance, United Technologies, you had a JV that was problematic. You had sales agents involved. Sanofi, there were distributors. Legg Mason, they used a Libyan middleman of some sort. Beam, there were sales promoters and distributors. Panasonic, you have vendors and sales agents. So you see them in all different contexts. You see them in almost every corporate case. So, I mean, it's one thing we always focus on is what are you doing about your third-party intermediaries? How are you getting confident that they're not paying bribes on your behalf? So that's one theme that runs throughout all those cases except one. Gifts, travel, and entertainment popped up a couple times again. United Technology, you had the typical scenario where there are trips and gifts provided to government officials. In Sanofi, you had a different scenario where there are false receipts and expenses submitted to build a slush fund up to pay bribes, but they were related to travel, entertainment, and gifts. And finally, hiring. There's another hiring case this year, or actually two hiring cases this year. Credit Suisse, which was followed in the line of some previous cases where the Princeling cases where investment banks over in the Asia Pacific region were hiring relatives of government officials to get banking business. And Panasonic also had a hiring component to it. There was a post-retirement job given to a government official, a consulting gig, after he retired to sweeten the deal.
By the way, one of the things I think is so challenging when it comes to hiring cases is, you know, from a prosecution perspective, I think it's very difficult to sort of tie the sort of quid pro quo together versus just ingratiation. But I think from a compliance perspective, one of the challenges is, you know, HR is typically kind of not necessarily tied into compliance in the same way that you would normally think. And so when people, you know, just traditionally for decades have gotten referrals, in part because somebody knows you and they like your company, I mean, it's not necessarily nefarious, right? That you've got a son or a daughter or a friend of yours or whoever, and you're like, hey, I really like your company. You know, can you, you know, send their resume to the right person? Suddenly has this level of scrutiny to it that, you know, I think is very different and requires companies to approach compliance and HR, you know, in a way that I think, you know, 5 years ago nobody would have really thought of before kind of BNY Mellon and JP Morgan Chase. I'm curious, you know, whether either Casey or Kelly, you've sort of seen any of that or sort of looked at those kinds of cases, you know, as you sort of move forward.
Well, I think just sort of stepping back that having a compliance department that is not just so hyper-focused on its own sort of traditional lane of making sure you have an anti-corruption, anti-bribery policy in place, training the high-risk areas in the high-risk countries, and then, you know, assessing risks down the road is important because that's sort of in the traditional approach because that's where the focus and the media attention or whatever was. And having the compliance group almost more like the hub of a wheel with different spokes, right? So that you have different departments within an organization. And the compliance may not be training every single group or pushing out information, but coordinating with them at least so that the HR department understands what the issues are that impact their day-to-day business, or the finance department understands what their high risks are, because it's a little bit different for each one, because the finance group may not be as concerned or worried about, in an organization like ours or any sort of multinational group, of these sort of HR hiring type issues, but the HR department needs to be much more aware of them. So sort of taking more of a holistic approach and using the compliance group as like a quarterback, not to use a sports metaphor, but that's what we do at Nike. So yeah, they're like a quarterback. And sort of approaching it from that perspective is wise.
Although one thing I'll point out in some of those hiring cases, in at least some of them, maybe all of them, there are actually policies in place. The companies identified that this was a problem. They had anti-corruption policies to address it, and they didn't have controls to enforce those policies, or they were circumvented. And in some cases, very blatant that they were tracking it with spreadsheets, like these are our referral hires, this is the business we've
got. Yeah, well, that's what I mean, like the quid pro quo, and there's a spreadsheet says, you know, this job for this deal, that makes
it
possible.
I mean, it is a tricky area, but some of the facts were fairly egregious in those cases.
Were the columns specifically labeled quid?
Just no, so but one of the emails, said, what's the quid pro quo for this job?
Right.
Nice.
Don't do that.
Not for doing the right way. Kelly, I mean, sort of same approach or thoughts? I'm just curious.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm at a company that went through a DOJ investigation, and we had a DPA settled in 2013. I came in 2015. So we've kind of had an evolutionary process of the entire compliance culture. And I think that there are some pros to that, by the way. You know, you have people who are very interested and they're sitting up very straight because they have had a recent experience. But one of the things that we've done as the program has matured is to address the different functions, like Casey is saying. So when we sit down and talk to the different functions, I'll take them one at a time and really talk to finance about the issues that we want finance to be aware of and be watching for, and partner with HR on some of these issues, and partner with business development because they've got their certain specific issues, of course. And so trying to not just have generic across the board training and that kind of approach with everybody in the company, but to take the time to target the higher risk functions so that we do have that partnership and we can be the center of the hub, and they come to us and they know what kind of questions to ask me and my team, and so they're spotting the issues so we can prevent these things from happening.
By the way, one of the things I would sort of recommend, because I had a couple of clients that had these sort of issues in terms of hiring, I would just say one of the keys is to segregate the responsibilities. So if you get a resume, you pass it on to HR, and once HR has it, you're not in control of it. It really can help, frankly, save an executive from him or herself, because there's sort of almost a natural inclination to chase it in a way that can ultimately be reviewed by certain people later with a jaundiced eye view as to the purpose behind it. And the other benefit, frankly, collateral benefit from doing that is, you know, it can often be incredibly awkward. Right, so somebody asks you to pass on, or a friend or a relative, or their resume, and you don't want to say no, but you also don't necessarily want to guarantee that they're going to. I mean, because you're hiring, it's limited people that you can hire. Having that segregation of duties not only protects the company on the back end in terms of being investigated for sort of a quid pro quo for hiring, but it frankly helps the executive say, well, actually, we've got a very sort of rigorous process in place. You know, it's great. I've got the resume. I'll forward on to the right people. They'll follow up with you and the like. And my clients now will get sort of an update, but they won't necessarily be able to control the process. But it allows the executive to take themselves out of it and say, I know you're great, or we have a great relationship, but it's those knuckleheads over in HR that are going to sort of handle most of that myself. So something to think about. So one of the things, speaking of sort of kind of the holistic approach and the different issues that need to be considered, in the past couple of years, including this past year, there continue to be more and more international sort of guidance or guidelines out there for companies. And on the one hand, there's some pros to that, which is it's great to get guidance from the government. On the other hand, it can be conflicting in some ways, depending on sort of the jurisdiction. But you now have guidance from, for example, obviously the U.S. Has put out guidance, but UK sort of Bribery Act guidance. You now have guidance from the French government, from the Brazilian government, from the German government. The Japanese have come out with guidance. And I'm curious, both Casey and Kelly, internally, what do you do with that? I mean, so on the one hand, it's great to have a roadmap. On the other hand, there are lots of different jurisdictions and markets, and you're trying to come up with a global program that doesn't have to be bespoke in every place that you're located. And as I think Casey was talking about, you can have a huge footprint and be thinking about these issues in multiple countries. I'm curious how you approach that and if you have any advice for people here.
I think we tend to think about things from a global perspective. It's nice to have this guidance if you have a particular issue in a particular place. But with everything that we're trying to apply, at some point you have to pick a standard. And with the anti-corruption, it's got to be the FCPA. That's where you have the most enforcement. That's where you have the highest risk of having some kind of enforcement action. And it tends to be the most restrictive, with the exception, obviously, of facilitation payments. And so we have to look at using something as a proxy for everything else. I think that's what's happening, too, on GDPR. We're going to have data privacy laws all over the world at some point. At the moment, that's the most restrictive, so that's the one I see people looking to as kind of a proxy, and trying to build programs that fit these proxies for the various laws that exist around the world, because you're right, we can't create a bespoke program in every country where we do business, and even if we did, we're going to do business someplace new tomorrow, and we just nobody has the capacity to implement something with that level of detail and intricacy.
From an investigative standpoint, I think the approach is similar, but at base you want a comprehensive, thorough investigation no matter what jurisdiction you're in. You want to understand the facts as best you can, and there may be some nuances here or there how you approach the investigation. I know we're going to talk about privilege in a little bit. That's one example, but I think the overall approach will still be the same regardless of where you are taking into account those nuances.
So Jason, I'm just curious. I mean, there's all this guidance that's out there. Obviously, the SEC and DOJ put out guidance in November 2012, and there's been additional guidance, you know, since then, both DOJ and obviously, you know, people make public statements and the like. But then there's all this other stuff. And so you know, both Casey and Kelly have sort of U.S.-based companies, but there's certainly a lot that come under your you know, review that may be like a foreign company that trades on a U.S. exchange. If they come in and say, hey, we've got our own guidance here, you know, sapin de, do you like my French accent? mais oui. But so we're following our French guidance and we think we're in compliance. Are you going to come in and say, well, that's not good enough because you trade on the U.S. exchange?
Well, if you're an issuer, then the books and records internal controls provisions apply to you. unfortunately or fortunately, depending on your perspective, the internal controls provision, it's pretty broad. It's a very broad standard. You have to design and implement a system internal controls that provide reasonable assurances that transactions are authorized and recorded appropriately. So that guidance might be helpful as part of that. And if a company comes in and says, well, you know, these are our risks and this guidance is, you know, tailored to the risks of the company, then, you know, it's something you take into consideration when you're evaluating their controls and their compliance program. But I don't think that that's the end of the analysis. You know, all because you comply with a foreign standard doesn't mean you necessarily met the standard of the accounting provisions of the FCPA.
No comfort for foreign companies. That's what I heard. Just translating.
If you're listed, if you're listed notes on a U.S. exchange.
All right. Okay. There we go. Onward and upward. So one of the other developments that I'm not sure people have followed or not. I'm a bit of a nerd on this topic, but the ascendance of DPAs. So deferred prosecution agreements, you know, obviously sort of in the late 1990s, the U.S. really began to use deferred prosecution vehicles as, a way to both encourage companies to cooperate and also to reward them for doing so. And while that approach has not been without, frankly, you know, fair criticism, by in different quarters, certainly there have been a number of countries that have now adopted that concept. So most famously, the U.K., actually passed legislation, came actually to DOJ and sat down and looked at DOJ's template about how they went about it in advance of submitting the legislation. Not only have the legislation, but have now actually gone after companies using deferred prosecution agreements. But you see that in other countries have now adopted similar approaches. Brazil in 2013 through the Clean Companies Act now have leniency agreements that they're using. The French in the wake of Sapin 2 actually brought on deferred prosecution agreements or a concept like that, which permitted them, for example, to do the SocGen case earlier this year. And there are others. Singapore is in the process of adopting it. Australia is considering it. So there's certainly an ascendancy of this idea of deferred prosecution agreements. I'm curious. I mean, SEC has a DPA approach as well, in addition to DOJ. You know, very kind of briefly, like, how does a company sort of qualify for that? How do they sort of come in and they make the pitch to SEC?
It's laid out in the enforcement manual, which is public if you want to read it. There's guidance on DPAs and NPAs. Broadly, a company to qualify, you're going to have to cooperate. You're going to have to enter into a tolling agreement. The DPA is going to require you to comply with undertakings and or payment of disgorgement or penalties. And you're going to have to admit or at least agree not to deny facts that would prove up a securities violation. So that's the big picture, what's required. As far as the guidance that the commission looks to for corporations, it's the Seaboard report, which came out, I believe, in 2001. And the factors Seaboard listed were self-policing, self-reporting, remediation, and cooperation. So it's looked through those lenses as how the commission determines if a DPA is appropriate or not.
Any sense, you know, the U.S. government has for 20 years, the U.S. government has had a policy of inviting everybody to the party, right? Like everybody should be enforcing. Now people are showing up, right? So the Brazilians are showing up, the Dutch have sort of come out in sort of a big way the last couple of years. UK's involved, the Canadians, the Mounties are around. I mean, there's folks everywhere sort of piling in. And I guess my question, Jason, to you is, you know, is the Is it a net positive or a net negative that you now have all these countries that have deferred prosecution of vehicles so they can move as quickly as the U.S. and be engaged in cases just as much, and there's sort of a risk of piling on?
I think it probably depends on the individual country, maybe even the individual prosecutor. I mean, if a country's coming in, DOJ and SEC is almost done with their case, and then they want to interject themselves, that could cause frustration for everybody, the company, DOJ, SEC. But if a country is actively engaged from the beginning and everybody's working in parallel and kind of coordinating those things or cooperating, maybe it's not that bad of a problem. I think it just depends on how it plays out in that particular country.
So Casey, I mean, your day job, I mean, you're investigating cases, you know, all over the world. You're sort of chasing these different matters. With this kind of new terrain in which what happens in the U.S. doesn't stay in the U.S., the oversight and scrutiny that's occurring sort of globally, you know, how does that sort of impact sort of the way you approach things, if it does at all, or make your job more or less difficult?
I think it sort of piggybacks on what we were talking about earlier with just sort of anti-corruption, the proliferation of anti-corruption laws generally around the world, and taking the scenario of looking at DPAs, if you're comparing two jurisdictions and one is the U.S. and you've got the SEC and DOJ to worry about, and the other is, you know, country X and they've got their own standards, you've got to see which one is going to require more. And if you think you're going to be faced with wanting to cooperate and wanting to pursue that, then you've got to choose the standard that's going to require more and go with that, and then realize you're not going to have to do as much with the less restrictive standard. But with DPAs, I think that's how you've got to approach it.
Well, so Kelly, I'm curious. One of the challenges, and we don't have time, you could have hours to talk about voluntary disclosure and whether you should go into the government and whether the benefits outweigh the costs and the risks and the like. But certainly one of the ones that sort of exists out there that's a variable is now you go in to see DOJ and SEC, which for better or for worse, and people can criticize both agencies fairly about whether their resolutions are consistent as you sort of look at them and you try to figure out why it is they reached whatever conclusion they did. It's certainly a lot clearer than some other jurisdictions around the world. So you go in to see your friendly SEC, enforcer or DOJ, but that may not be where it ends up. It could very well end up, being referred to somebody in Brazil or elsewhere. I'm curious from an internal perspective, as you sort of think about the ways to move forward, does any of this kind of weigh on sort of your job or what you do or how you go about it, or maybe even the messaging that you have internally to your own clients and constituents?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that if you go back even 5 years ago, but certainly 10 years ago, the only thing you were thinking about when you talked about voluntary disclosure was, am I going to go to DOJ and SEC? And now that is just one piece of it. It's where are all of the jurisdictions that this conduct may touch, and who may we have to report to? And if we disclose to DOJ and SEC, then does that mean you have to disclose in these other jurisdictions? The answer is probably yes, because they're going to find out. And so what does that mean, and what does that look like? And what does that do to your business? Because by the nature of these cases, what you're talking about disclosing is a potential improper payment to a government official in the government that you're about to have to go report to. So there are a lot more nuances to whether you're going to disclose now than there were before everybody else joined the party.
And just to add to that, too, one thought is for those in private practice out here that are advising companies like us, is you may have vast experience investigating anti-corruption or corruption cases around the world with an eye towards interacting with the SEC or DOJ. You may be fluent in whatever foreign language in the jurisdiction you're working, but you may not have the experience actually interacting with the government enforcement agency of that country that you may now have to go self-report with and negotiate with. And so as you're approaching representing a company in a situation like that, it's good to sort of think down the road in that regard and know and be able to recommend who are we going to retain in this particular jurisdiction to help us navigate that, because and being able to admit, which lawyers don't like to do, that you're not equipped to do it.
That's right.
We all do. Private practice in-house, you want to be able to take it on and do it, but that's not always the case. And you know, I would imagine that the enforcement agents in different countries aren't as reasonable and kind as Jason Rose here at the SEC Forward.
Well, I think, too, we also used to be able to wait until we had more facts. Yeah. Before you had to start having that conversation about do we voluntarily disclose. Now you need to be talking, before you even begin the investigation, if this really turns out to be a thing, where might we need to disclose, and therefore how do we need to conduct the investigation? Because what you can't do is ignore data privacy laws in France and then have to go disclose to the French government. That's not going to be good for anybody at all. So, again, to your point, we need advice on all of the various jurisdictions sometimes that might be involved and what their requirements are with respect to privilege, with respect to data privacy, all of those kinds of things, so that you can figure out how you're going to investigate this thing earlier in the game, which by doing so may or may not get you in trouble when you do finally disclose, because it's taken a little bit longer to figure out how to go about investigating properly.
Well, so you raised two issues that I want to make sure we pause and tackle. One is privilege, and both you and Casey were talking about it. I think it's particularly important for everybody in this room. And number two is sort of the data privacy component. The former I at least appreciated when I was at DOJ. The latter, data privacy, I never believed that. I was always like, that's just, they're just obstructing, they're holding back. Well, you redacted this whole page.
That's right.
Now that I'm in private practice dealing with counsel in a variety of other countries that say, you know, no, that's illegal if you do this. You know, we have documents that we're producing to DOJ that look like Swiss cheese and from Switzerland, and they're like, this is not going to – this doesn't fly. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. So let's take a moment and sort of talk about sort of both areas. So first, privilege. So obviously, I'll just assume that people in the United States here sort of sitting in this room sort of understand Upjohn v. U.S. My dad, by the way, is an attorney at Upjohn. I got stories about that one if anyone wants to hear it. If you ever read it, by the way, nobody's ever read that case in decades. They just know what it stands for. It's an FCPA case before the FCPA was on board. It was about payments and whether the tax deductions being taken by Upjohn were legitimate business expenses when they were actually bribes. So there you go. In any event, so Upjohn is obviously the rule of the road here, but just recently the SFO, for those of you who follow it, suffered a big setback. They had won a case in the UK related to privilege, and I think most practitioners, probably including some enforcement people in the US, kind of gasped at the fact that, you know, they have to turn over interview memoranda and the like done by outside counsel as part of a external investigation, you know, on behalf of a company and the like. But it was just reversed by the English Court of Appeal. But it raises an important issue, which is when you're conducting an internal investigation, or Jason, when you're sort of evaluating it and making some decisions, you need to decide, is this privilege, is it not? Can we compel it? Can we not? How do we go about protecting the privilege when we're in a different jurisdiction? And so I guess the first, let's start with Jason, which is, so how does the SEC analyze the application of attorney-client privilege during an investigation? Is it based on the local law? So if it's Greece or Switzerland or France, you know, is it privileged there or in Azerbaijan? Or do you sort of apply the U.S. standard given that it's in the United States?
I mean, I'll give you an anecdote how it's played out for me once in the context of a whistleblower submission. And privilege issues tend to come up a fair amount in whistleblower submissions. And a lot of times the whistleblowers and or that their counsel are a lot more lax about how they view the privilege than the government. The government tends to take a more conservative view. So sometimes you're getting information that might very well be privileged, and we have filter teams in place to address that. And in one of those situations, an in-house lawyer in a jurisdiction where in-house lawyer communications were not deemed to be privileged produced a bunch of communications that were, you know, of relevance to us, and the counsel had taken the position because that local jurisdiction wasn't privileged that we could review it in the U.S., no problem. Well, we send it up through the filter team, and we have people who look at that in our trial unit and whatnot, and they determined, even though in that jurisdiction there was not privilege, we would treat it as privilege under U.S. law. So I got the redacted submission back to me with a lot of the blacked out stuff like you mentioned earlier, and you have to work around it.
I will say my own experience was similar in nature, which is I had a guy fly on a plane from somewhere in the Middle East, go to D.C. I remember it because, by the way, it was during the holiday party, and we had rented a margarita machine, and I was not allowed to leave the room to go get any. But so he came in, and he was an attorney from the Middle East, sat down and wanted to tell us about some conduct that had occurred in the Middle East. And he said it's not a violation of attorney-client privilege in the country that he was from, because it was protecting a crime. Not attorney-client fraud, wasn't the crime fraud exception. And we went to Preo and we asked whether that was appropriate. And they said no, that we had to, if it wasn't an exception through the crime fraud, that we would have to respect the privilege, which we ultimately did. It didn't help the company because the guy then went to the Wall Street Journal and it wound up on the front page. they didn't care about privilege. But it certainly, I don't know at the end of the day what the way DOJ would or wouldn't in any particular instance sort of tackle it, but I definitely think external counsel and in-house counsel should be thinking about, is this going to be considered privileged? And so I guess, Kelly, when I think about the international context, whether it's investigations or compliance, you're doing a risk assessment, you're conducting an investigation. I mean, how do you approach that, or what do you think about in order to try to protect the privilege as much as you could for the company in anticipation that this might become an issue?
We're thinking in those terms, and also we're a little bit smaller, so we just don't have as many people. So we think in terms of who's going to be your fact witness if you've got to have one, and who's going to be whose privilege are we trying to protect here, and so we kind of divide work accordingly, which means I end up doing a number of HR type investigations because I'm not the labor and employment lawyer. Those are fun. And vice versa. If we need somebody to be a fact witness on something that's going to turn out to be a sanctions or an anti-corruption type issue, then we're going to change roles so that I can try to maintain my privilege as much as I can. We also recognize that as in-house folks, yes, there's a privilege, but there are a lot of times when we are answering business questions as well. So if we really need to protect a privilege, that's the time you need to be calling outside counsel so that we've got some additional coverage there. So we think about these issues as we're making different decisions, whether it's risk assessments or compliance audits or investigations, any of those different challenges. And I think just keeping it at the forefront of your mind is probably the biggest step to making sure that you can make the best call and have the best argument down the road if you need it.
Yeah, I would just add to that that it's really important to understand the basics of privilege even here in the U.S. From an in-house perspective, and making sure that your business colleagues understand the basics of privilege, and that, for example, you can't just copy a lawyer on an email and cloak it in privilege. There's no such thing as a cloak of privilege out there, in my view. It's got to follow those basic rules, and then beyond that, you've got to really fully understand the privilege laws in the jurisdiction where you might be interviewing employees or others or investigating. So that you, if there is some limited protection you can rely on, you're following the rules on that. And then from there, just making sure that you're acting in accordance with it, and so that you're careful about who's taking notes in witness interviews and producing records that might be subject to those requests from enforcement agencies down the road, so that you're not inadvertently creating documents that aren't going to be protected by privilege or would otherwise be protected here in the U.S. but might not in whatever jurisdiction you're working.
Well, so Casey, so staying with you, because we've talked about data privacy as well, and it's certainly taken on in the wake of GDPR, I think a much greater focus for companies given the potential downside penalties and the like. I'm just sure, curious, Casey, how does data privacy, GDPR-related issues impact how companies are approaching internal investigations and dealing, for example, with data that you may need to move for an investigation from one location to another? Is that something that you guys have now sort of are dealing with?
What's GDPR? No, I joke, but I don't know a lot about it. And so we rely on the experts, and that's important. Again, it gets back to the point about saying I'm not equipped to handle that particular issue. Let's go find the right lawyer that is. And so we make sure that we have our privacy experts in the jurisdiction so that they can give us the proper advice so we don't run afoul, first of all. And if we've got to figure out a practical solution, we can do so appropriately.
Right. Well, and relatedly, and I've certainly had clients that have struggled with this, which is from a compliance perspective, forget investigations for a second, there may be limitations as to what the questions you can ask. Mm-hmm. So just think about third-party due diligence, something Jason was talking about earlier, which you know, really is at least 90% of the cases, I think, in the last decade have been third-party related. There are some jurisdictions where you're not allowed to ask about somebody's past criminal record. Is viewed as sort of their history, they've paid their, they've done their debt to society, and they've moved on. And so there are real limitations in terms of that. I'm just, there needs to be judgments made, obviously, as part of this. But Kelly, I mean, how do you guys think about that, you know, as you sort of go forward and have to grapple with data privacy versus sort of having a robust compliance program?
Well, I think kind of to Casey's point as well, I don't think there's anyone out there who has developed a this is the answer to the question yet. I think all of us are continuing to struggle with it, and the more we all talk about it, we'll settle into a place where we can benchmark against one another and figure out how to comply with this stuff, because it's tough. It's hard. Part of it is always going to be a risk-based decision matrix, just like the old data privacy issues where you had Chuck saying, that's not true, give me the data anyway. Sometimes there
I was so unreasonable back then.
I tell my clients, I've actually never heard a prosecutor use the word reasonable. but there is some truth to that, because there are different rules in different jurisdictions. And there are times when you have to evaluate what's the bigger risk to the company. And that's in-house and outside counsel perspective as well. So how do we balance that and make the best decision we can, even if it's not a great decision? I think that in GDPR, and I think all of us know just enough about it to be dangerous at this point, but you have that right to be forgotten. You can have a former employee who calls and says, I want you to get rid of all of the data that you've ever had about me. Now, there's an exception that says if the company needs it to conduct business, then you can maintain it. Well, where are interview memos going to fall in that? Where are reports of the investigation going to fall in that? Where are training records going to fall in that? And I think that these are the questions that we're all going to continue to struggle with for a while until we start to see what enforcement looks like and what the interpretation of these rules looks like.
So SEC is going to be reasonable in considering all this. Is that just looking for some comfort?
I haven't had GDPR come up in a case yet, but I've had various data privacy blocking state secrets statutes come out for the last 15 years. Mm-hmm. My experience, there's always a way to work around it. It's either the company gets comfortable with the risk. I mean, they maybe it's raised.
With the risk.
They get comfortable with the risk and they produce it. Or sometimes they assist you with drafting a MOU or an MOA
sure.
request. So maybe they say, we can't produce it to you directly. We want to get it to you. Ask for these documents, direct it to this person, and we'll produce it as soon as we get the request from the regulator or the criminal authority. So that happens too, and that's another worker.
Yeah. He didn't say reasonable. Just so
yeah, he did not. He did not say reasonable. And by the way, the one thing I'll point out about that, so it sounds like, oh, well, if you can't produce it because of data privacy, just go to the government, work up an MOU or an MLAT. Boom, problem solved. Let me just tell you, what clients say is, are you fucking kidding me? We're going to go to the authority I got 2 minutes, Steve. I got 2 minutes. We started late. So just, I'm good. I got a call in 2 minutes. So, so the client says, wait, you want me to walk into the office of the local data protection authority and tell them that we want to produce a bunch of stuff, or the local prosecutor's office, to like produce a bunch of stuff about a bribery investigation in that country? Like, oh my God, like, boom. You know, and then I'm like, well, there are other options.
They'll
you
give
know.
You a subpoena or a grand jury time subpoena.
To, right, right. Time to redact some stuff or take some risk. Anyway, all right, so Steve said stop. We didn't have time to get into, but I will just point out to everyone, United States versus Hoskins, if you haven't read it, read it. What I will say sort of very briefly about Hoskins is simply I don't know any clients that work with me that think Hoskins changes FCPA compliance one bit. It's a jurisdictional issue whether or not essentially you can reach an employee of a multinational corporation that works for a foreign subsidiary. So Hoskins was a UK citizen working for a French company that had a subsidiary in the US, and he was charged with conspiracy to violate basically a domestic concern statute, the 78DD2.
Why don't you diagram this out?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. You got to sort of diagram it out. There's this. So the bottom line is there's sort of a very narrow exception that's now been under the Gabbardi principle reached by the Second Circuit. It's complicated, but at the end of the day, I don't think anybody from a compliance perspective says, you know what, we're going to design a compliance program that sort of carves out those people. You're still going to have a universal one, so I don't think it changes that. It is useful for the practitioners who represent individuals. All right, thank you so much for your time, everyone. Woo! It's 2 o'clock.